name, but I didn't, right? So, I mean, that's like, it's yeah, I mean, I just think those lines are really beautiful. It's interesting to think about like what gets lost. So like one of the major points that you look at in the book, or one of the major terms, I guess, is a better way of saying it, is umma, right? And like this idea of like, right, of community that can get sort of translated into ideas of state or nation. And I wonder if maybe you could tell me what an anarchist umma in your interpretation of Islam is, and then how it gets like framed sort of in a more, I don't know, fascist or micro macro fascist kind of way.
So thank you. You know, and again, it's very enjoyable talking with you, Scott, because the element of plurality, in a certain sense, that you just noted in your last set of comments. And look, all we learn from oppression is learning how to repeat it unless we decolonize. And the irony is all these monotheistic traditions started up as oppressed collectivities, right? Prior to arrogance, rule, and power, seducing, and in a certain sense, corrupting the original heart and message. So the intent and the action behind it. You know, it's difficult to talk about the ummah without talking about the dawla. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to say a few things with regards to the dawla.
Yeah.
Just because of a lot of the misconceptions. So, you know, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, like I said earlier, they often repeat sort of and promote the dehistoricized view that there is such a thing as an Islamic state. There is no such thing as a state that existed in pre-modernity simply because it's a Euro-colonial invention within itself. But we did not have the word for a state. So Arabs and predominantly Arabic speakers, let alone Muslims now in general, will use the post-colonial term dawla to mean state when it actually does not mean state. Even ISIS refers to itself as a dawla Islamiyya. So much for a Muslim movement that was out to change the world, that knows and claims that it was an authentic kind of Islam, actually knowing who and what it is, to use the concept of Islamic state, let alone a dawla Islamiyya. So obviously this represents a distortion of dawla's meaning. Dawla stems from the verb dal, which morphically as well as semantically falls between two verbs, dar and zal, which means to rotate and to go away. So the exact temporality is a part of the understanding of it. And usually what we had within pre-modern Muslim modes of governance, several dawlas even within one dawla, it represented a confederate model, if you will, decentralized, that all composed a part of this ummah, broadly speaking. But they mostly rotated around, like I said, connotations of temporality, change, rotation, nothing as much as a fixed order that aspires to, or at least the modern state aspires to. So that's essential. The condition of well-being, or the change and alteration of well-being from one person to another, or between groups, one day I have my health, the next day I don't, that's part of the understanding of the dawla. It's subject to change. We can find it in chapter 59, chapter of the gathering, verse 7, the Prophet's distribution of the spoils of war, referred to as a dawla in a certain sense. Do not hoard the spoils within only an enclave of you, distribute it amongst the community in its entirety. And the same thing with other verses in the Quran, the chapter of the House of Imran, for instance, verse 140, that discusses the cyclical nature that I noted of human vicissitudes, insofar as triumphant days were usually replaced by defeat another. So it ultimately means to turn, to alternate, but not to be fixated. It doesn't have a static place, organization. Like I said, there are a multiplicity of dawlas within one dawla, loosely referred or establishing a decentralized confederacy under the rubric of a so-called ummah within itself. Now, a dawla cannot ferment an ummah. And, you know, an example of dawlas that existed, for instance, there was the Hamdanite, there was the Buayid, yes, the Shidi, the Ayyubi, the Mamouli dawlas, right? Within the Abbasidian ummah, if you will, during that time, and Muhammad Ali and Ali Bey Kabirs within the Uthmani ummah, right? But the fact that you had a seat in Damascus did not mean that you had a Syria, or you had a seat in Baghdad did not mean that you had an Iraq within itself. The ummah within itself is, because the Quran did not, and God did not lay down, and this is so fascinating, because the concepts I talked about earlier are micro anti-authoritarian concepts, right? The Quran did not lay down a macro structure of governance. It left things loose. It left, and it placed the idea of dawla there, And at least the idea of ummah. You want this non-territorial concept. Why? Because Islam is a message for the world. So it is seeking, and Muslims should be seeking engagement with those who are like and are unlike them. Okay, with the spirit that we talked about earlier, insofar as it's the process of getting to know. If we take that as a foundation, and the ummah structure itself was left loose, and what we saw for the most part through 1,443 years is a decentralized model that existed organically. Were there. Sure, there was nepotism, sure, there was despotism, and so on and so forth, and gradual hegemony that fed into. But we have to distinguish between what the decentralized confederacy also allowed. It allowed mobility. There were no politics of citizenship, of surveillance. There were no controlled societies, disciplinary societies in the way that we understand them now. You can contest a despotic ruler by coming up with an interpretation of Islam that would expose that ruler's corruption and so on and so forth. So there was far more means to resist. Power is far more malleable than it is now. It's more, far more fluid. The idea of the ummah that I'm drawing upon is the first ummah, the first polity that was established, that the Prophet, peace be Muhammad, peace be upon him, established, which is founded on the Medina Charter and the treaties of Hudaybiyah or Sulh al-Hudaybiyah. It was a multi-faith community, including Jews, Christians, Sabians, even polytheists, in which what bound this community together are the ethical, political, social justice responsibilities that they had with one another. This was also underneath the understanding of what I spoke about earlier, insofar as there was a nuanced conceptualization amongst the early polity of it is not a matter of a Muslim, non-Muslim, because the person before me is a believer. If I choose them as part of my ummah, and they're included, that they are a believer, they are a mu'min, whether they believe in exactly the same, whether it's referred to as, forgive me, Yahweh or Adonai or Allah or Jesus or Buddha or Mother Earth, whatever it is, that's a name. What's in a name? Nothing and everything. The everything comes precisely because of the ethical political commitment that that Buddha, that Yahweh, that Allah, that whatever would have us believe in. And so if we begin to think about now, the ummah constructed from that perspective, a coming community, a community that has a porous membrane such that it's able to expand, it's able to grow, it's able to mature vis-a-vis folks that are coming in and folks that are leaving at the same time equally. And as this community interacts with other communities, because the ummah is often misinterpreted also as a nation, which is highly problematic because, again, the concept of nation within itself doesn't exist except in contemporary Arabic lexicon. The Quran used the words qabail and shu'ub. Qabail are small tribes. Shu'ub are larger populations. So there was an indicative of these being more quantitative qualifiers than they were qualitative, and an appreciation for the fact that even small communities, even small tribes, are worthy of not only engagement and interaction and exchange with, but if need be, protection from other communities that would oppress those small tribes. And hence that sense of collective responsibilities that folks would share with one another. So that becomes the idea of the community. It is one that existed during the early Muslim period, unfortunately. And it began gradually, of course, to become misconstrued, right? For instance, we see with the idea of the Dhimmite or the Dhimmi, right? Jews being dressed in particular garbs as Dhimmite. Now, the Dhimmi is a beautiful concept because the Dhimmi means one whose life, whose neck if you will, lies within my hands. So it is worthy of protection, right? But then we begin to see gradually Muslims, this is 1,200 years later, wanting to dress Jews or non-Muslims in different garbs in order to distinguish themselves from Muslims and so on and so forth. And the beginning of misconstruing again of concepts of beautiful concepts of towards ulterior motives that are meant to other, that are meant to other and not create an affinity towards, but to create as outcasts, to mark them, to mark their bodies, to mark their traditions, their ways of being and existing within the world. So yeah, that's the concept generally, loosely of, if you will, of ummah, because the concept of caliphate doesn't as well, and this is worthy of mentioning, doesn't exist. Again, caliphate is a derivative of the concept of khalifas, and we're all khalifs in the Quran. The Quran certainly uses khulafa in the plural just as much as It's used in the singular. But Abraham, peace be upon him, was described as an ummah unto themselves. So the ummah is a very also beautiful concept and term, so far as, again, that extrapolation of what it means for an individual, let alone a body, a communal body, to embody particular or to embrace particular ethical political commitments, if you will, grounded in, of course, social justice.
Yeah, well, that makes me think another sort of strand that you pull out, and it recurs in the book, is this idea of hospitality. And I think this really connects to what you were just talking about. So I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on that from an anarchist Muslim point of view, and like sort of, and maybe if you have some thoughts about how we could infuse an anarchistic Muslim hospitality into our daily practices, whether or not we're, you know, Muslim.
Well, the crisis, you know, within the left, as you know, my dear, is the fact that we're brilliant at tearing each other apart. The right doesn't actually have to worry about anything in that respect. They maintain always this unified stance, regardless of MAGA, regardless of Iraq wars, regardless of whatever it may be. Right? The left, no. And so for a while now, for about more than 15 years ago, I started to work on what is referred to within Islam as usul al-ikhtilaf and usul al-diyafa, the ethics and politics of disagreement and the politics of hospitality, if you will. How do you offer hospitality to the other? And of course, I draw on Jacques Derrida, the beautiful Jewish Algerian Derrida, you know, who faced everything from obviously anti-Jewishness in France to let alone in Algeria itself. So he got hated on both sides of the world. But I also draw on Leela Gandhi, on a lot of other thinkers, if you will, within the process of hospitality. In Islam, there is such a thing as the ethics of hospitality. And so far as how do you offer hospitality to the other? Part of it begins with, we need to do away with these Zoom kind of chat discussions, because this is no forum for, well, it is. Any forum could be used. But can you imagine if we were face-to-face? If I entered your home where you entered mine, how the conversation ostensibly, in a very Artudian way, would have been different. Our gestures in terms of saying hello, the ability to embrace, how we would be seated down, the affect of all that, the offerance of gestures of food, of water, of sustenance, right? Mm-hmm. Expressions of love, the ability to look the other in the eye and connect, such that you don't have to sit at the end of the day across from a dinner table and say, honey, what's wrong? Say something. Out of this fear, this compulsion to speak. It involves things as, you don't demand the other's name. The other's name is to be given willfully. It needs to be surrendered. It means that when you are my guest, you are the owner of the home. It means the switch of the playing of the roles. As far as a diyaf, you become, in a certain sense, the commander of, if you will, the house, right? Whatever it is that you need. It's, you know, at least traditionally, it's for 3 nights, if you will, and so on, that act of hospitality. But obviously, I don't want to read into things too literally. Of course, it could be 3 nights. It could be longer than that if we're building community. But we need to give ourselves space, time, which we don't allow within movement organizing, to actually get to know one another. How many times have we been to protests, say Iraq war and Afghanistan war, even with regards to what's going on in Iran or otherwise? I can guarantee you, and I said this before, the anarchists that went out during the anti-war Iraq, Afghanistan protests, how many of them went to a mosque? How many of them picked the Quran? How many of them have spent time with Muslims? How many of them have cooked meals or broke bread with Muslims? How are you supposed to claim that you're engaged in solidarity? Again, I appreciate the gesture of going out on the streets and being allies that way. But there's no investment in relation. Investing in relation means I have to create the space, the time, the opportunity for the process of getting to know, let alone to have an ethics of disagreements by which conflict resolution can begin to manifest and to take place. Because no two people were aligned 100%. And so far as their ethical political commitments. Say I meet another anarchist, or say they meet me, and I'm anti-capitalist, I'm anti-racist, and anti-authoritarian, but you know what, with regards to the queer stuff, I'm not on board with that. I'm not on board with the trans stuff, right? The other party has to decide at this point, do we have enough bonds of affinity? And am I willing to be patient with Muhammad such that they understand the relevance and importance of gender and sexuality and intimacy and so on and so forth? And how much patience and time should I give Muhammad? Because as Darida posits, we can't just have our doors open to everybody. One would not invite the rapist, the misogynist, etc. But if none of us are pure, we have to allow room for that morphing, that metamorphosis of the self indeed are becoming. And that becomes the capacity. There is no ideal Muslim. The ideal Muslim is Muhammad. Muhammad died. He left us the practice. And they have left us the oral tradition. But we're also always striving to be ideal Muslims. But we're never going to reach. There is no ideal anarchist, even if you consider, as I was called by a classical anarchist, actually, in the conference, and this is true, in Loughborough many years ago, Emma Goldman and Bakunin and Kropotkin, in the context, I can tell you the context, he asked me one of the first times that I was presenting on Islam and anarchism. This is an anarchist that came into the conference dressed in a suit, tie, everything, white, of course. And he says, well, last week we made a whole bunch of effigies of Moses, of Jesus, of Muhammad, and we burnt them. And what is your opinion with regard to that? This is over 12 years ago. And I said, well, I neither know what Moses or Jesus or Muhammad look like besides the blonde, blue-eyed Jesus, but I don't mind that Jesus, but sure. But I don't know what Muhammad looked like. If that gives you some sort of cathartic satisfaction, okay, but I obviously would not do that with, if you will, our elders. I wouldn't do that with Emma or Bakunin. He's like, yeah, because these are our gods. So much for no gods, no masters. but that mentality, even if we are to assume that Emma, Bakunin, Kropotkin, and again, they were incredible subjects, subjectivities, personalities that existed ethically, politically, staunch with regards to social justice that appeared in a particular historical period and of Jewish background. And we could sit down and talk about sort of the secularization of that and so on and so forth. But nonetheless, that embodied certain commitments. But nobody is perfect. And then even in that case, one is aspiring to be like Emma, like Bakunin, like Kropotkin, like whatever. So there's no ideal stage at which one arrives. One is constantly in the process, like I said, of metamorphosis, especially if we can see that I have to fight all my inner fascisms, period. Somebody who's white has to deal with the same with regard to their white privilege or whatever else privileges that they have going on. So that becomes, as I noted, the idea, if you will, insofar as the ethics of disagreements. And disagreements, and I number them, I believe, 4 or 5 in an essay that I wrote that got published in the Journal of Political Theology. You know, they happen because of ego, they happen because of ideology, they happen because of ignorance and other reasons. But ideologies don't exist. No tradition, as much as even religion. And again, I'm very careful because we didn't get into the discussion of the difference between religion, faith, and spirituality. These are different concepts. They're interrelated within the Quran, but they're not one and the same thing. And institutionalized versus non-institutionalized religion, particularly in the context of Judaism and Islam, because we don't have a central authority, we don't have a priesthood, and we certainly don't have a church, you know? So what that ostensibly then also means in terms of the ramifications and the repercussions of that. So it is reflecting through all these processes of Muslims may claim that Islam responds to everything, but as Islam is in engagement with the world, a non-human life is an extension of creation and it interacts back. This is a not non-thinking religion and you have to apply it. And it depends on space, time, and hence ethics and not just moralities. And here I mean by, you know, thou shalt not kill or the Ten Commandments. Of course, these are general, beautiful commandments, but God forbid if somebody threatens you or I in this particular instant or moment in which we're sort of collectively together, we reserve the right to self-defense. What that manifests as, we can restrain this person, we use a knife, we use whatever it is, means that are necessary, that's a whole different other question. But it becomes a question of context, of ethics, and not morality. Moralities are nice. They're general commandments that we should abide by. But we have to leave room for ethics, and hence the ethics of disagreements and hospitality that way. And we lack them. We lack that kind of investment and beyond the liberal, multicultural, interfaith initiatives, and all that really just reinforce the greater macro fascisms and totalitarian orders that already exist.
So there's so much I want to talk to you about, but like there's two questions I definitely want to get to, and maybe these will be the like sort of last, because we're just make this digestible for listeners. But
thank you.
So from what you're saying, and that, both of my questions like really connect to what you were just saying. So, but one of the major sort of like revolutionary liberatory projects of the book is grounded in a decolonial sort of land-based liberatory project that for you is like really important to like draw like wisdom and solidarity from indigenous movements with diasporic people like Muslims, Jews, and black people who are descendants of, you know, people from the Atlantic slave trade. Yeah, I want to know a little bit more of that vision that you see, where like indigeneity and diasporic sort of identities can find connection, and then what the role of the land is in relation to that. And that might connect also to your ideas of hospitality too.
Thank you. Thank you very much. No, that's a brilliant question. So indigeneity, I don't read indigeneity as a racial concept. And it's very dangerous, in my opinion, to read it as such. I distinguish, of course, between indigenous peoples, indigenous nations, and indigeneity. I think indigeneity, I relate to the concept of fitra within Islam, the inclination to do and being born as good, the inclination to connect with community. When was the I and I? When I was a we within my mother's womb, that was socialized as this individualist, narcissistic I, this materialist I. So our inclination is to connect with community, it's to connect with non-human life. Prior to us being dressed in pink or blue in a hospital, styrated space, and so on and so forth. So compartmentalization of identities, slotting, acting in authoritarian ways insofar as, okay, I see Scott, I can categorize Scott, I can slot him, I understand my power relationships with them, and I don't need to invest anymore in the getting to know process in the act of hospitality. As migrants, and this is why I tell the story of the original migration and persecution of Muslims, when Muslims moved to Abyssinia, first to Medina, then modern-day Ethiopia, and this is part of not only the getting to know, but building a revolutionary community. Why were Muslims not allowed to respond while they were being persecuted? And the verses that permit them to engage in qital, not jihad, but actually qital, which is the literal word for war or battle, if you will. Why was it revealed after Muslims had been decimated? So that they may learn the greater importance of a lesson. That, of course, as the Quranic verse says, migrate, of course, if you're being persecuted, and go and establish relations with people on whose lands you are now moving to and relative to them, and find your common commitments together and build that community together. That is far more important. And then the right to self-defense, that's easy. It's easy to pick up a gun. It's far more difficult to learn how to grow food with a community on land that is not yours, and to grow food more than your literal or our little narcissistic gardens that we have in our backyards, if we even have backyards. So this idea of migration, I understand that Muslims and a lot are suffering. They come from everywhere, from Afghanistan to Iraq. They are queer Muslims from Egypt. Some who have internalized Islamophobia, they want nothing to do with Islam. Some who remain Muslims, but are now moving to the context of settler colonial US and Canada. And I've seen it happen both ways, whereby folks completely let go of the responsibilities, they embrace the free lifestyle, they go out drinking, partying, and again, I could care less for that sort of a narrative. People deserve leisure, they can do whatever it is that they want. But it's the abdication of responsibility, whether you buy into leisure or not, that I find to be highly problematic. And whether you're a Palestinian or not, we're ultimately settlers on stolen land. What becomes the responsibility insofar as the getting to know? How many Muslims have been to reserves, have even spoken to an indigenous person or nation? This becomes the issue and this becomes the problem. The fact that we have not invested, the fact that we have internalized anti-blackness within our Swana communities and reproduced that anti-blackness, the complexity of anti-blackness, if we take Israel as an example, Black Mizrahi, Ashkenazi, Sephardic, now oppressing Black Palestinians, let alone non-Black Palestinians. It's complicated. We live in a complicated world. But this is where the investments in relations becomes very vital. So as migrants, I would extol Muslims who have brought into the narratives of hyphenated American citizenship, of assimilation, of representation, professional or not, within the hierarchies of the state, let alone within racial capitalism, to sit down and to actually begin to think through the responsibilities, such that when they go out and they protest in the name of Palestine, perhaps they may realize the hypocrisy in what it is that they're demanding, because there is no free Palestine, not from the river to the sea. The road to Jerusalem runs through the Grand River and vice versa. It's as simple as that. There's a lot of literature that's already been written, Dan Alwan, Stephen Shalaita, Mike Krebs, and one can go on and on, of the resonances that exist, not mapped out identically, because no two things are, which is two traditions are, resonance between what is going on insofar as Palestine, insofar as indigenous dispossession here. And the society relies on its pillars of anti-indigenous dispossession, genocide, land, cultures, traditions, languages, resurgence, and anti-blackness. And yes, as you noted, it's ironic that, you know, a third and fifth of the transatlantic slaves were black Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula and West Coast of Africa. So the fact that we're engaged in this kind of anti-blackness is obviously very sickening. And one sees it even in the context of Egypt and blackface and so on and so forth, but that's part of Egyptians or North Africans even fighting for the right to be recognized as whites within the U.S. Constitution, within the census, and so on and so forth, at the early turn of the 19th century, if you will. So, and it was Coptic Egyptians, actually, that led to that, that battle, having been persecuted in the context of Egypt. So this is a reproduction of oppression, and if we're going to break that cycle, we need to engage in that decolonial material land-based resurgent act, where land is returned to its proper stewards. And it's not for the sake that indigenous people can kick everybody back on the boats from which they came. Indigenous people are far more dignified and respectful than that. But since that we learn to eat from the same dish with the same spoon, this becomes the element of sharing, of reciprocity, of getting to know, and of investment. That takes time. And you're not going to do that within the so-called, per se, urban metropolis, because reses don't exist within the urban metropolis, despite the migration or displacement, if you will, of a lot of indigenous people because of poverty and for all sorts of other reasons, into urbanization, if you will, into the metropolis. So it has to deal with moving about with fantasies with regards to cosmopolitanism, with regards to skyscrapers, the geographies of land, how land itself is being organized, what the organization of land does insofar as defining what is private and what is public. In Islam, that is very salient. Now we live in a day and age in which privacy doesn't exist. There's a camera post-Snowden age that exists on every single cell phone. We're mined, we're digitized, we're harvested. We're numbers on a machine or for a machine. So the investment means that you're ostensibly, and to me, solidarity means that those that you're standing in solidarity with, you are prepared to die because their causes are yours. And you're doing so in the name of not only their name, but your name as well. Because I, as a Muslim, cannot accept that I come over here, that I get a job, I get an education, I have access to OSAP, I have access to a good quality of life, medical care, otherwise, that an indigenous person would not have access to. As they're, again, lacking clear water in every place from Athabasca, or committing suicide, because that exists too. Youth or indigenous youth. So that becomes the concern at this point. It is not a matter of rhetoric, it is a matter of investment, and the land needs to be returned. And Muslims can contribute alongside with indigenous people to develop, as indigenous people's traditions have, a different form of governance, horizontalist governance, that isn't interested in recuperating the nation state or using the nation state as a tool for liberation. Not for them, and certainly not for other people. And of course, Afro-Indigenous futurities are very much intertwined, because transatlantic slaves didn't have a choice in coming here. They are the only community or only group that is exempt, in my humble opinion, from being referred to as settlers, because they're not. They were forcibly displaced, transplanted on the bottom of slave ships, with millions that are going to the bottom of the ocean that extends as part of the process of what Christina Sharp refers to as that wake, or even Tiffany Letabo King calls the shoal, that extended shoal that bridges sort of land and sea, right? That extension of oppression, of repression, but also agency of resistance. So Muslims can either join. The irony and the problem is that we're all on the same boat. We can see the Titanic. We can see the icebergs headed right before us, and we're headed for them anyways. And by that, I mean global warming or climate change. Look, it's not going to matter to the Earth or Mother Earth whether we are Muslims, Jews, whether we are leftists or conservatives or whatever it is. Climate change is going to do what it is, and our Mother Earth is going to do what she wills.
Laura.
Laura?
Laura. Laura.
This is sensational.